Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the Federal Reserve do for the national and global economies, and how do its actions affect the financial climate in which regular people spend, save, invest, and earn money? A new documentary by filmmaker Jim Bruce combines clever graphics with perspective from noted historians, economists, investors, and current Fed officials to explain how the institution works and elucidate both the successes and failures of its policies over time. The documentary is called Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve, and it's been held over for another week of showings at the AMC North Park Theater in Dallas. My guest, John Malden, is featured in the film as an expert commentator. He's a hedge fund advisor and president of Millennium Wave Advisors based in Arlington. He's also an author and founder of Malden Economics. John, welcome to Think. Hi, John, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome to Think.
Yes, good to be here.
Start, if you would, by talking about how the U.S. dollar became the world's reserve currency.
It happens basically the same way that the Roman currency or the Constantinople currency, the British pound, a country becomes dominant. There are several things that have to happen for a world, for a country to be the dominant power. It has to be large and liquid. If you were looking at strength and, you know, management and fiscal responsibility and all that, you'd be looking at Singapore or Switzerland. But those countries don't have enough capacity to be a world reserve currency. You can't trade internationally in the Singapore dollar or the Swiss currency. There's just not enough of them. So it's got to be a global power with global trading. There's got to be the ability to provide those dollars. Now, the United States has done that because we've had, you know, a massive trade deficit over the decades. And so we provide dollars to the world, especially after Nixon shut the gold window. Mm-hmm. We're a dominant military power. You don't see people wanting to flock into the Canadian dollar for world trade. Canada's a wonderful country. Love it. I've been bullish on their currency relative to the U.S. dollar for a long time. But they just don't have the dominant military presence. And you want some country, you want to feel this country's going to be there. Mm-hmm. There has to be some sense that it's a stable country, that its policies are going to ensure that that currency is going to be there for 10 and 20 years. It's got to be very, very liquid. There's no more liquid markets than anywhere than in the U.S. In fact, one of the odd things is that we saw developing world countries, central banks, complaining about Bernanke's policy of quantitative easing 2 years ago. He's putting too much money. He's putting a risk to the dollar. He's going to make our currency stronger. And now that he's wanting to take it off, they're complaining that he's wanting to take it off, and they're worried about the negative effects. So emerging market currencies seem to worry about everything all the time. But we are the it's a dominant currency. That happened after World War I. We became the biggest country. And especially after World War II, it became very clear. I mean, that's how you ended up with Bretton Woods in 1944. Even in the midst of a war, the rest of the world had to decide what was the currency going to be. So they met up in Bretton Woods in New England and decided that instead of a gold policy, a gold standard for the rest of the world, the world would have a dollar standard, and the dollar would be backed by gold. Of course, we reneged on that in 72. Because our deficits were ruining our ability to be able to maintain that dollar standard, that gold standard.
Well, given the ties of every other currency in the world to the U.S. dollar, that obviously makes the Federal Reserve a uniquely powerful institution in the world. It controls our money supply, regulates banks, ensures the soundness of the financial system, and importantly here, sets interest rates. Talk about the importance of the Fed setting interest rates.
Well,
the Fed sets interest rates because it's trying to increase the desire of people to invest in things other than bonds or to slow the economy down. And so you've got people sitting, unelected officials, sitting on a board in Washington, D.C., deciding whether the economy should be going faster or slower. And they do that because they have two mandates. When the Fed was first started, their mandate was just for stable money. We're going to have a Federal Reserve, they said, that is going to ensure no panic, so it'll provide liquidity in moments of panic, but it's going to ensure that the value, the buying value of the dollar, the purchasing price, would be stable. And then we added employment, that the Fed is now responsible for employment. And once you make it responsible for employment, then they start feeling that we need to be responsible for the business cycle. And even though Congress can't repeal the business cycle, that's just part of human nature. We've been having business cycles up and down since the Medes were trading with the Persians. The Federal Reserve now feels its mandate is to go in and try to step on the gas and provide liquidity, provide more energy, if you will, to the economy by lowering rates when the economy is slow and unemployment is high, and then when inflation comes back to increase rates.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't do that, as they didn't in the 70s, Congress and the president clearly wanted them to have an easy monetary policy, and the central banker at the time said, the chairman said, okay, well, this is what the government wants, and we're part of the government, so we're going to go along with that, even though it's probably not the best policy. And rather than showing some independence, which Volcker eventually had to do, as a Republican, I have to give Jimmy Carter credit, he appointed Paul Volcker, knowing that Volcker was going to increase interest rates. And the only outcome that was possible once Volcker was appointed was that we were going to have recessions. And we had two very deep recessions. That came from a Federal Reserve not being focused on maintaining the value of the money, letting inflation get out of control, and then a Federal Reserve having to step in and say, inflation's now at 15-18%, interest rates were at 21. I mean, you know, inflation was crazy. So somebody had to step in, and that's what Volcker did, and then you get the opposite. So the central bank is important. In 2009, late 2008, they had to step in and provide liquidity. The markets, we were truly at the brink of the abyss, and we looked over, and it was a long way down. And the Fed had to come in and do some very unconventional things, some things, quite frankly, that probably weren't in its charter, probably weren't technically legal, but we were in the middle of a crisis and we needed to do them anyway. But they've continued to pursue those policies. And now we have a situation where we don't know what the unintended consequences are going to be.
Well, let's talk about unintended consequences, because there's a lot in here about Alan Greenspan, this guy that was called the maestro, and whose policies for a lot of time made people a lot of money and sort of worked until they didn't, and then turned out to have some pretty major unintended consequences.
Greenspan was the recipient of a golden age of lowering interest rates. And yes, he continued a policy of Volcker to, you know, strategically lower interest rates and strategically fight inflation over time. But he also came in in an era of optimism. He benefited from the compromise and that Clinton and Gingrich created. Who knew that we'd be nostalgic for Clinton and Gingrich together? what an odd world.
What's
this
the
has
world
become.
Come to, right?
Truly, these two guys who were not what you'd want to call philosophical running buddies sat down and said, here's how we're going to compromise. And we ended up with a balanced budget. And that balanced budget created a lack of supply of U.S. government bonds, which drove prices, interest rates down, because people were looking for that. They were looking to buy them. There a lot of companies, pension funds, insurance companies, all sorts of investment companies have a mandate to buy as a certain percentage of their portfolios these bonds. So interest rates go down. So Greenspan benefited from that. And then after the crisis in 2002, then 9/11 in 2001. Greenspan took rates down too low for too long. We ended up with a housing bubble. He and then Bernanke specifically denied that there was a housing bubble. They said even if there was a housing bubble, which we don't think can happen because we've never had seen housing prices turn down nationwide before. That was their specific quote. That unintended consequence of a housing bubble created the 2008 credit crisis, which, you know, somebody failing to pay for their mortgage in Orange County, California, ended up bringing down banks in Europe.
So essentially what happened is that a lot of people believed they were gaining value in the real estate they owned when, in fact, those values had been artificially inflated by the availability of so much cheap credit.
A house is a place you live. It's not an income. Its value is in the cost of what it would be to rent. So if you're... Up until 6 months ago, 5 months ago, I have leased a home for almost 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't see any value in buying, and there hasn't been a lot of run-up in Texas real estate. I actually have bought a home a few blocks from KERA's headquarters in Uptown. I bought a place in a high-rise because... It's some place that I want to live, and I'm comfortable with it, and I'm comfortable with the cost of the place versus what it would cost me to rent. But 5 years ago, when I leased a home in Dallas, I could lease a home for about a third of what it would cost me to buy it on a monthly basis. And you know, the owners at the time couldn't sell the home, because nobody would pay them that much because the prices were out of whack. So now the cost of the rentals come back up, and the price of the home, in fact, did come down to it came down about 20-25% from what he was asking for it 5 years ago. But he sold it, the price had come up, so it kind of met a level. And that's, if you want to think of the value of a home, the value is in what your rental would be. And that gives you some kind of an idea of what the income would be from the house. And that puts a price on the place.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is John Malden. He's a hedge fund advisor, author, and founder of Malden Economics. And he's featured in the new documentary, Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve. We'll come back to the conversation and take your questions and emails in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Malden. He is an author and founder of Malden Economics. He's also president of Millennium Wave Advisors based in Arlington. And he is featured in the new documentary Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve, which was written, directed, and produced by Jim Bruce. That film has been held over for another week of showings at the AMC North Park Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we've just opened up the lines at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, John, in talking about the Federal Reserve and the things that have gone right and wrong in the film, and I realize that you were interviewed in the film and not a producer of the film, but one seems to get the idea that it's never been an issue of corruption, that the individuals who are working there have, by and large, tried their best to do what was right. But you almost get the sense that you know, nobody's got a crystal ball, and we have to be careful about placing too much faith in the Fed.
What has happened is that we've seen shifts over time in the reigning economic theories. And we end up placing a great deal of trust in those theories, and which is, you know, that's human, that's what we do. But we now have an economic paradigm that is Keynesian, and that means John Maynard Keynes created a philosophy about how central banks should work. And we have in the academic world, what we call coast economics, the East Coast, which is MIT, Harvard, Princeton, which are the primary sources of big economics, and then Stanford, Berkeley out in the West Coast. Mm-hmm. That is the reigning paradigm today versus the Chicago School, which was developed by Friedman, which would be monetarists. And there just aren't any real monetarists other than a few, Federal Reserve presidents, regional presidents. There's just not that many monetarists on the Federal Reserve and the FOMC. And that theory is what's driving economic policy. And so I just had somebody on a previous interview ask me, Who do I favor, Yellen or Summers? And I've said it doesn't make any difference because they both are operating under the same concept of how a central bank should be operated. And given that paradigm, they're going to do generally the same things. And until that paradigm changes, until there's a real crisis, I don't think it will change. And so we're going to see the Federal Reserve doing more of the same in the next crisis. The next crisis we see, they're going to take interest rates down. They're going to have more quantitative easing. They'll come up with more three- or four-letter programs, just like Europe did during their crisis, like Japan is getting ready to, is doing now. And they're going to try to push the country back into growth. And they do that with the unintended consequence of financial repression. Low interest rates are wonderful if you're borrowing. And so I'm going to get to, you know, when I finish my construction on my apartments and we can consolidate them, and then I'm going to go to a bank and they're going to give me a longer-term mortgage. And I want the interest rates to be as low as possible when I borrow that money. However, there are times when I want to save money. Mm-hmm. And if I go to the bank and say, here, I want to give you some money and you pay me interest on it, the bank looks at me and says, well, we're not going to pay you very much, if anything. And I go, oh, well, how can I live on that money? I mean, I like the low interest rates as a businessman or as a borrower or a mortgage. But, boy, I hate them if I'm retired, if I'm saving money, if I want to save money for my future or for my kids. It's that financial repression. Bernanke is very, very clear in that he wants to, and the movie has his several quotes of it. I mean, the producer of this movie, and I would urge everybody to go see this documentary, Jim Bruce did an incredible job of weaving together a story of the history of the Federal Reserve, the consequences of their policies, good and bad, why we need them. I mean, this isn't an anti-Fed or a pro-Fed. It's a let's think about what the Federal Reserve does documentary. But Bernanke very clearly said, we want to move people out of bonds and into stocks. We want to move people out of interest-paying instruments and into risk, more risky assets. Well, that's all well and good unless you're retired, and you shouldn't be taking a lot of risk. So now it means the money that you've saved for your retirement that 6 years ago your financial advisor said you can get 5% a year on your savings and it'll last you until you're 98 years old and you're not going to live to 98, so you're in good shape. Well, now you're getting 2% and you're dipping into your collateral and you're only 74 and, uh-oh, you're in trouble. And that's a direct result. It's an unintended consequence of Federal Reserve policy. I mean, they don't sit around in the meetings and go, what can we do to screw people who are retired and on pension and can't earn any more money? That's not what they're doing. They're worried about unemployment. That's their mandate. And the unintended consequences is that people who are savers don't get good returns. They don't get enough to be able to generate a lifestyle that they thought they were going to have.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's take a call now from John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Sure.
I love your show. First of all, the proper, appropriate definition for the word inflation is an increase in the total stock of money, not to be confused with price inflation. However, the mainstream media and folks, the authorities, tend to blend those two into one. So would not the current bull market in stocks just be a parallel to the housing bubble in that since this is the most incredible inflation the world has ever seen and all this money, quote, if you want to call it that, has gone into the stock market, isn't that in fact just another bubble created by the Fed? Given that the inflation has taken place this time in the stock market, and what happens if all that money actually gets into the real economy? What will happen then to price inflation?
John Malden, what do you think?
Oh, well, he went straight to the heart of the matter. We don't get to kind of have some softball questions and then warm up to the real question. He's absolutely right. And inflation, and I've written several letters on it in depth, inflation is in the eye of the beholder. It's a very, very contentious concept. And you have, you know, economic conferences where economists get in and they debate over how we should measure inflation, because how you measure inflation makes a difference. It makes a difference on how much you're going to have an increase or decrease you're going to get in your Social Security payment. So how they measure inflation is important. And Friedman, our monetarist that we were talking about, would say, well, the money supply is the critical item, and if the money supply grows too fast, if we have too much liquidity, that's where you see the inflation. And as the caller was talking about, where we've seen inflation is in asset prices. First we saw it in homes, now we're seeing it in the stock market, and frankly, those are inflations that people like. They like it when the price of stuff they own goes up. We don't like it when the price of stuff we buy goes up. We don't want to see our gasoline go up. We don't want to see the price of our food go up. We don't want to see the price of insurance or medical care or anything else goes up. That's bad inflation. That's a cost. But we like it when the price of stuff that we own goes up. And so we kind of have this two-headed person that on one side wants to see what we think of as good inflation. That's the stuff that we own going up in value. It makes us feel good. But we don't want to see the bad inflation, the stuff that we buy. And what's happened is the Federal Reserve has created all of these reserves, they've pumped an amazing amount of liquidity into the economy. And a lot of it's shown back up on the books of the Federal Reserve. Their reserves have increased dramatically. I mean, you know, about a huge amounts. Banks and those reserves are called excess reserves because banks have chosen to put the money back at the Federal Reserve rather than lend it out. Now, they're not lending it out because they don't have people that they feel are creditworthy enough to borrow them. They're not excess to the banks. If a bank came and said, here's a loan I want to make, here's somebody that I think is going to give me the return I want, and I think my risk is justified, the bank's going to lend you the money. The bank is looking to lend money. They're not sitting on their pile and go, oh, well, we don't want to make money. We can get a whole 25 basis points from the Federal Reserve. They just don't see opportunities that are justified by the risk. And especially if you're a small bank today, and I talk to people who are on boards and running small banks all over the country, they're complaining that regulators come in and tell them, ah, you can't make those loans. You're taking too much risk. And so on one hand, the regulators are saying, we don't want you to loan money out. We want you to take less risk. And then you have the Federal Reserve and other officials coming in and saying, well, we want you to take more risk. We want you to go out and loan more money. And the poor banks are caught in the middle. And I'm being facetious when I say poor banks. I hope the sarcasm came through.
We got it.
But it's when the economy does eventually turn, and it always does. I'm actually long-term bullish on the U.S. What will happen is that those reserves will come off the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and will make their way into the economy. And it's what's known as high-powered money because a dollar will eventually be, in a fractional reserve banking system, eventually becomes $9 or $10. And all of those trillions of dollars of reserves on the Federal Reserve balance sheet could easily come back into the economy if we start having what Keynes called, you know, positive animal spirits. If we started going, I want to invest, I want to borrow, here's my good opportunity, here's my collateral, I'm going to take more risk. Well, that gets pumped into the economy, and all of a sudden it's the 1970s show all over again.
Do you imagine a long-term consequence, you know, given that the homeownership rate in this country is well north of 60% and has been for decades, of all the people who, over the past couple of years, with mortgage rates at historic lows, who went in and secured, in some cases, 30-year loans at just a little over 3%, is there a long-term consequence to those individuals sort of hanging on to that cheap money as interest rates inevitably begin to climb?
Well, it's a positive consequence. I remember I graduated, I'll date myself now, I graduated from Rice in 1972, and I had taken a student loan for 4 years. I think it was a total of, it would have been a total of $12,000 at 3%. And I had some god-awful long period, like 15 or 20 years to pay it back. At 3%. And so that's $360 a year. I got into 1979 or 1980, and I got lucky, and some businesses worked, and I was making money, and I could have paid the loan off. I looked at that 3% that I was paying versus the 18% that I was getting in my money market account. Mm. And I'm going, I can't afford to pay this loan off. It's too cheap. My dad was the same way. They had a mortgage in 1966. They bought a home in Bedford, Texas. And I looked at the size of their mortgage in like 81 or 1982. And I said, Dad, why don't you just pay it off? He goes, can't afford to. Hmm.
It cost me more to have to figure out how to pay all the taxes and everything, and they do it for me because it was the interest rate was so cheap versus what it was at that day. And so if you can get a low mortgage today, it's probably about as good a time to, you know. I think we're going to see rates go down one more time. That's just a personal view. But, I mean, this in general, we're going to look back in the future just like we did in the 70s and 80s, and we're going to look back and go, wow, we'll never see rates that low again. And the reality is we may never see rates as low as they got this last round.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ashton on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Ashton.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. From reading a lot of articles in various places, they keep talking about this impending threat of a student loan bubble. I wanted to ask, is it real? Is it not real? And maybe what's a worst-case scenario we could see come from that if it were to occur?
A bubble is something that I think of more like the housing market or the stock market, where something is going to affect the general economy. Has the student loan market gotten out of whack? Is it getting to the place where students are borrowing money that they're going to have difficulty paying back? Absolutely. I mean, we're over $1 trillion now. The entire growth up until like the last month or two, or maybe a quarter, the entire growth of the credit markets, other than the government, for the last 3 or 4 years has been in the student has been from student loans. Everybody else, mortgages, credit cards, car, everything else has been going down.
Let me jump in here so we can take
money. So now we're watching students. People are borrowing money as students.
Let me jump in here so we can take a break and you can continue that thought in a moment. My guest is hedge fund advisor, author, and Malden Economics founder John Malden. He's featured in the new Jim Bruce documentary, Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve, which has been held over for another week of showings at the AMC North Park Theater in Dallas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Malden, founder of Malden Economics and president of Millennium Wave Advisors based in Arlington. He's featured as an expert in the documentary Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve by filmmaker Jim Bruce. The doc has been held over for another week of showings at the AMC North Park Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And John, before the break, I don't know if you've got more to add, but you were saying that all the recent growth in the credit market has been in student loans. Everything else is shrinking.
That's right. I mean, other than the federal government's debt,
mm-hmm.
but in the private, you know, corporations have been reducing debt up until recently, and the private market has been. I mean, that's what happens after major credit bubbles, which is what we had. And it's normal. I think that we're going to become a nation of savers again as we boomers start to get older, as they realize people looking at retirement, that they're going to have to save more. They're going to need more than they thought they were going to have in the past. And so we're going to see that credit go down over time as a continuing piece. A rise in savings.
We have an email here from Paul in North Branch who says, the Federal Reserve has been buying $85 billion in federal bonds each month for many months. Where do they get the money to do this? If they just create the money, do they have a responsibility to withdraw a like amount over time in the future?
Very good question. The answer is they do create the money. The responsibility to remove it depends on whether inflation starts becoming a problem again.
and I don't want to get too technical or wonkish, but that goes back to what we call the Fisher equation, where it says that inflation is not just a factor of the money supply, as Friedman said, but it's actually a factor of the money supply times the velocity of money. And what we've seen for the past 8 or 9 years, but starting much more with the onset of the crisis, is we've seen the velocity of money come down. So I was writing in my letter 5 years ago that the Federal Reserve was going to be able to print more money than monetarists, or especially gold bugs and Austrian, what we call Austrian economics, could possibly imagine, and that there would be no inflation, which is what we've seen today, because the velocity of money is going down. The Federal Reserve is going to have a problem when the velocity of money starts rising again. And by the way, it always rises. The velocity of money is a very, very long-term mean regressive, in the sense that it goes way above the average and it goes way below the average over long periods of time. And it will bottom at some point and begin to turn back. And when it starts to turn back, the supply of money is so large now that inflation could come back a lot quicker than anybody suspects. And that means the Federal Reserve will have to take that money back. They'll have to sell bonds into the market and sop up those excess reserves, which will have an effect of slowing the economy down. But they're going to have to do that, otherwise we'll see 70s-type inflation coming back. So the Federal Reserve is banking on something happening. They're hoping. I don't know that hope is a strategy, but they're hoping that something happened like in the 1930s, is where they created these large reserves, and then they just sat on them. And you go through World War II, and we saw this big period of inflation, but they had financial repression, so they kept interest rates low. And we outgrew, if you will, as a country, the monetary base, and we were able to absorb it without the Fed actually ever reducing reserves. That would be a wonderful outcome if you're a central banker. You just can't count on that. And more than likely, the Federal Reserve at some point is going to have to reduce those reserves, which is just going to send the market into all sorts of a hissy fit. They're not going to like that. I mean, good grief. The Fed is talking about tapering. Now, tapering, to the listeners, is the Fed is buying $85 billion a month of Treasury bonds and mortgage bonds. They're talking about maybe only buying $70 billion a month and then slowing it to 60 and just gradually slowing those purchases down, which they need to do. I mean, we need to get back to a system where we're not on morphine. But just the simple fact that they're wanting to take us back to normal has central banks all over the world screaming and yelling that it's going to mess things up, and investors are worried, and bond rates are going back up. God knows what will happen when they try to reduce reserves at some point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Brenda in Dallas. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I've got a question for your guest, and it's in reference to CD rates. I'm a retired person who I have a real very low tolerance for stock. I don't like the way that they do that stuff. So I'd like to know, what is his thought about CD rates, and does he think they'll ever go back up, where we'll start to see a gain in your money when you invest in CDs?
What do you think, John?
Brenda, you are the classic person
that is the victim of unintended consequences. You are properly saying to yourself, I don't want to take a lot of risk in stock markets. I have saved X amount of money. This is what I've got to live on for the rest of my life. And a certificate of deposit is a conservative way to do that. There might be other ways you could get a little bit more, but a certificate deposit is a nice proxy for low risk. And you're not getting any money. The answer to your question is rates will go back up. Not this year all that much, not next year, but eventually they're going to go back up. And but it'll take time. That's just the nature of financial repression. Honestly, my view is that we're probably going to be in this deleveraging cycle for, you know, another 5-6 years. It takes time to move through these things. I mean, I'd love it if our government stood up tomorrow and said, here's how we're going to deal with the debt ceiling, and here's how we're going to deal with the deficit crisis, and we're going to figure out how much health care we want and how much we want to pay for it, and here's our plan going forward, and we're going to have this rosy financial future. But I don't think that's likely to happen, given our current state. So it's going to take some time, Brenda, before you're getting what you think of as a reasonable or livable return on your CDs.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll take another call, this time from Carol in McKinney. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I was just wondering, Mr. Malden was talking about the way that we came out of the last Depression, and since we're not in the same situation economically that we were then, like vis-a-vis China and the shipping of so many jobs overseas, how would we recuperate from it now?
That's a very good question, Carol. Lots of good questions today, Chris. If you go back to 1978 or 1979, the Japanese were eating our lunch. We had high inflation. Unemployment got to 10%. Inflation was high. The value of the dollar was falling. We were in what Jimmy Carter called a malaise, no question about it. The answer to the question of where will the jobs come from was, I don't know, but they will. That's what free markets do. They look for opportunities, and when they're not having to worry about things, and right now I think if you look at the data from the National Federation of Independent Business, if you look at the surveys, small businesses, which is where new jobs are created, I mean, sometimes those small businesses become Google or Facebook, or Microsoft, or, you know, but they start out as small businesses. They start out with a handful of people in a room going, I've got this idea. And you've got to give them a comfort of looking out over the future that they know what their costs are going to be. And small businesses are very, very concerned about what their future costs are going to be. They don't know what it's going to cost them for health care. They're concerned about what's going to happen to taxes. They're very concerned about the regulatory environment, and we can talk about all sorts of reasons that, you know, the government should become more involved, but at the end of the day, government doesn't create one job. They take money from taxpayers, and they'll go hire people to do other jobs, but at the end of the day, it's private industry and taxpayers who create those jobs, and that's where I think eventually that we'll see the new jobs created. If you go back to 1870, we saw a massive shift from an agrarian society, because technology and world trade was pushing local farmers off their farms. They no longer needed to hire so many people to pull the harvest in. They had these cool new things called the McCormick Reaper that would do the work of three or four people. And So those people had to go to the cities and find new jobs. In 1900, the number one job in America was no longer agriculture, but it was personal servant. Whether it was a maid or a butler or somebody to deal with the horses in the city, because we still used horsepower, and we know what horses are messy, and they've got to be fed. That was a huge shift. And if you go back and you look at the papers at that time, they were worried. There were people saying, oh, we've lost our agricultural roots. Well, today, 1% of the people are feeding the rest of us. And nobody worries about, oh, well, we need to get 20% of the people back on the farm. No, we don't want to do that. We'll create new jobs. That's what an economy does. Now, will they be the jobs that we had last decade? No, they won't be. There'll be something new, and that's why we have to learn. We're going to constantly be reorganizing ourselves. I'm excited about where the world's going in 10 or 20 years. That'll be the next. I've got a book coming out in a month on Federal Reserve policy, but the book I'm writing next year is going to be what the world looks like in 20 years, and I'm very optimistic about it. I think it's going to be an exciting time, but that transition for some people is going to be difficult. There's no question about it.
Well, and if you're, 25 or 30 years old, holding out for 10 or 20 years for the economic picture to look fantastic is a relatively easy thing to do. It's a little bit harder to stomach if you're nearing retirement or you have big needs.
I'm not arguing that the transition is going to be easy for everybody. And it creates all sorts of unintended consequences. We talk about the hollowing out of the middle class. Well, that's because a lot of those jobs are now being done automation. We're producing more stuff in the United States. Sometimes I read people about how we're no longer a manufacturing power, we're no longer in a manufacturing economy. Well, it's not really true.
We're still
the US,
top
we're producing
exporter, right?
More stuff than we ever have in history. Mm-hmm. We're just doing it with a lot fewer people. Hmm. We've become far more productive. And that's a trend. But that's been a trend for 250 years since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And that trend's not going away.
John Malden is a hedge fund advisor, author, and founder of Malden Economics. His insights are featured in the new documentary Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve, which has been held over for another week of showings at the AMC North Park Theater in Dallas. John, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.